I want to welcome you to our forum tonight. We're going to have the opportunity to hear about the World Council of Churches Assembly from some of the people who really understood it, I think, went with the... No, Arnold isn't so sure. We know better. And each of them went with their own perspective and their own role within the assembly, and so each person's going to reflect from that point of view. And then after each person has a chance to talk, perhaps 5 minutes or so, then we would like to open it up to the rest of the group to ask whatever questions you might have about their impressions of the World Council Church's Assembly. I asked John Yoder and John Gushi, was there an overarching scriptural theme in addition to the general one, Jesus, the light of the world? Was there a particular scriptural passage or something? And there wasn't, for it had a lot of portions to it. But he was able to recommend to me that I read this portion from the first letter of John. That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked upon and touched with our hands, concerning the word of life. The life was made manifest, and we saw it, and testified to it, and proclaimed to you the eternal life which was with the Father and was made manifest to us. That which we have seen and heard, we proclaim also to you, so that you may have fellowship with us. And our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ. And we are writing this that our joy may be complete. It is in that spirit of fellowship that we'll begin talking about what happened at the Assembly of the World Council of Churches. I thought John Taylor perhaps would like to start. Would you begin by explaining your role?
I've been closely involved with the World Council Assembly for the last 3 years at least. The staff in Geneva have had the role to pick up the many suggestions that have come for the assembly from the member churches. We've worked with an assembly preparation committee, which had representatives from the Orthodox and Protestant churches, men and women, laity and clergy, and so on, the usual ecumenical mixture on the committee. And they have shared their ideas with us, as have the various meetings of the Central Committee of the World Council over the last 3 years. We've seen the theme take shape, and then we've seen the flesh being put on the bones of the basic skeletal plan. We've had a lot of work to do in terms of trying to get the right balance of participants. A lot of churches were very reluctant, for example, to include young people or women in their delegations. We had a lot of persuasion to do. We've also been heavily involved in a much more careful preparation process for this assembly than I think any previous assembly. It could be that even some of you in your local parish life encountered some of the team visits that were going right across the world in the year before the assembly. We started with an idea of about 25 team visits, and we ended up with 80, partly because the churches around the world were so concerned that they should, if possible, be part of the preparation. Preparation was sometimes, of course, done just by Bible study or issue study within churches and between churches. But there was also this whole network of team visits which brought a mixture both of those people who would be at the assembly, but all those who also some who wouldn't be at the assembly, into this network of grassroots level sharing. Instead of just going to the church offices, the riverside drives, and so on, the visitors were going into local situations and visiting not only the churches, but the neighbours of the churches, who might be Jews, or who might be people of no faith, or in Asian situations might be Hindus or Buddhists or Muslims. Now, all that preparation work was leading us towards this special moment, 3 weeks of the assembly itself. Of course, some people were very worried. Should we invest so much time, so much energy, so much money, too, in a major assembly? Incidentally, the whole 3 weeks of the assembly costs less than the average cost of 1 day of a papal visit to most Western countries. The costs have been borne, as all the costs of the World Council are borne, by the member churches themselves. They've rallied round magnificently, and of course the Vancouver people and the Canadian people in particular have rallied round magnificently to make possible the assembly. So here have I been with all these different balls that I've had to juggle. Judy asks me what my particular responsibilities were in the assembly. One was related to my assignment with the World Council. That was to be responsible to identify and then to welcome guests of other faiths. It's a slightly embarrassing thing to be told that you can have a maximum of 15 people to represent all the religions of the world. There we were with our 3,500 Christians. And we had our 15 friends of other faiths.
Nairobi, there were three.
But there were only five at Nairobi, so we were already better than at Nairobi. And we were certainly better than New Delhi, where they wouldn't even accredit Hindu journalists. It was strictly Christians only. We had, therefore, a couple of Jews, three or four Muslims, three or four Buddhists, a Sikh, a member of the traditional religion of Canada. And I had the responsibility of preparing those people, both in a preparatory meeting 6 months ago, and then of trying to make them feel at home in the assembly. I was backed up in that job by a marvelous team of volunteers from the Vancouver communities. Every day, right through the assembly, there were volunteer Jews, volunteer Muslims, volunteer Hindus on campus, manning an interfaith center on the campus, putting on programs which we thought might just bring a little special interest group of 30 or 40 people, and in fact had capacity standing room audiences ranging from 150 to 350, depending upon what room we were in. So for me, that was a very exciting thing, to feel that at least in a slightly symbolic way, the assembly was going beyond just our immediate Christian family, and it was reaching to our neighbours of other faiths, but also that we in the assembly were being given the challenge and hopefully finding the grace to listen to our neighbours of other faiths, to listen to what they had to say to us, just as they were ready to listen to what we had to say to them. I won't go into that now. The last thing I'll say in this introduction is that I was also, as a staff person, heavily involved in the major business part of the assembly, in the sense of the second week of the assembly and reports in the last 2 days of the assembly. Here I would confess that we were perhaps over ambitious. We tried to do too much in too short a time. It was partly that the structure of the assembly was laid down for us very firmly by the preparatory committee. Quite rightly, they said, we want a full week really to celebrate and pray and meditate and reflect upon the theme, and only then do we want to get into the issues of church unity, the issues of mission, the issues of peace and justice, of education, of participation by women and young people, and so on and so forth. But it meant that from the Monday of the second week, we were on a very tight schedule, and I was responsible for the coordination of all of that. It's still somewhat in a whirl from that process. But it was an exciting process because it was a way of seeing the ecumenical agenda whole. Everybody was involved in a particular chosen issue group, and yet we were trying to make the connections across the board. That if we were struggling in that peace and justice section, for example, we realized that the struggle for peace and justice has a great deal to say about the unity of the church. It has a great deal to say about the way in which men and women and youngsters all together can cooperate. It has a great deal to say, too, about styles of education and learning and unlearning and beginning again. So there I was, juggling these many balls, and then, of course, involved in the helter-skelter process of getting all the reports in. Now I'm breathing a sigh of relief, but I assure you it's a sigh of grateful relief for the privilege of having been able to serve the Assembly, just as I feel grateful for the whole 10 years I've had of serving the World Council.
Thank you. We have tonight three Johns, a Dan and an Arnold. So I thought alternating would be good. Dan's right here and I need his watch. So should I borrow that and put you on?
It was built in 1954, and I hope it lasts.
Oh, my.
My involvement in the Assembly as an accredited visitor came about because I was asked to join a faculty of international people who came to Vancouver School of Theology to run a program of graduate education simultaneously with the Assembly and located right in its midst, 100 yards from the worship tent. And on that faculty were people like John Beatty, former director of the Bossy Ecumenical Institute from Kenya. Christopher Stendahl was there from Harvard, Bob Nelson from Boston, Stanley Samarta from Bangalore, I think he is now. He used to be head of the program of the World Council for Dialogue with Other Living Faiths, and so there are 10 of us. And what we're asked to do is about what we're asked to do tonight, and that's to do the impossible, that is to do instant reflection. If it's instant, it's not really reflection, and if it's reflection, it can hardly be instant. And I think we're so close to the Assembly that you'd have to take everything we say this evening in light of that fact, that it is really a first impression following very immediately on an extremely complex church gathering. I have three impressions that stand out for me of what happened in Vancouver. First having to do with worship, the second with the role of women, and the third with witness. Now, I won't comment on the first two. I suspect they will be touched by others here. Gina and others followed the question of women in the Assembly more closely than other aspects. And with 106 different meetings taking, 806 different meetings taking place during those 3 weeks, no one person could get in touch with the entire process. Concerning witness, which is one of the three I'd like to comment on, I think that the Vancouver Assembly, and here I'll just be bold, will go down in history as the assembly where two important strands of the ecumenical movement converged, probably more significantly than at any other time since the birth of the World Council in 1948. In 1948, the movement called Life and Work, which had to do with the church's concern for political, social issues, church-world relations, converged with Faith and Order as another separate movement and really formed the World Council. Later the missionary presence was to enter in 1961. But they have remained somewhat separate all through the history of the World Council. Faith and Order Commission, dealing with questions of doctrine, faith, the order of the church, has had its own commission, had Roman Catholic members on it, somewhat independent and somewhat separate from a good bit of what the World Council has done. I felt that this assembly, an important linkage was made between those two strands of the ecumenical movement. And simply stated would be that the concrete action in the field of the church's witness, common witness and service in the world, were linked very directly to very serious and fundamental theological concepts. It is basic doctrinal, foundational elements in the life of the World Council. I needn't go into detail on that, it would take us in a different direction, but that linkage to me is a key to the success of Vancouver, and I'm hoping that the time proves me to be correct, that it will be bearing good fruit in the future. You may want to get into that in the discussion, but I've not talked for 4.5 minutes. So.
You're keeping the track. John Yoder?
I'll try to do what Ben did and label the areas that I care about and want to talk about. I have several hats when I get invited to World Council events. I was first invited with reference to the theology of mission right back in 61. I was invited sometimes because they thought I was evangelical, and that is still an abiding agenda of the Council's identity. I am sometimes concerned, especially in the faith and order realm, with the issues of the nature of the church, especially as represented by the issue of infant baptism, or the challenging of infant baptism. And that is a topic which was not resolved as well as some others in the recent convergence document on baptism, etc. But for now, I'll speak only of my being part of the pacifist Peace Church caucus. In 1948, the first assembly document said, war is contrary to the will of God. But Christians have three different answers to whether you should participate in it or not. And we spelled out what those three answers were, and Reinhold Niebuhr was part of the drafting committee. Then they said, this constitutes a call to the theologians. That means they recognize this as an issue that ought to be talked about theologically. But it wasn't in any organized form. Evanston in 1954 said the same thing a little less clearly. And again, there was no discussion of the issue of war as a theological question. And there still hasn't been. It is one of the issues on which Christians are divided confessionally. That is, there are churches which reject war as a matter of confession. The Mennonites, the Brethren, the Quakers. There would be others if they hadn't been wiped out or evolved away from their original position. And there are others which affirm the moral propriety of war as a matter of confession, including the Lutherans and the Reformed tradition. The Roman Catholic tradition does not affirm it as a matter of confession, but of tradition. That has never been carefully talked about as a theological difference within the World Council. And I'm a member of the caucus that keeps telling the World Council that there's something non-ecumenical about that refusal to discuss that matter. The reason they don't, I've been told clearly by some staff, is that the World Council can only afford to work on issues where there's a chance for a breakthrough. And if you won't have a breakthrough, there isn't any point in running through again the pacifist, non-pacifist debate. Well, it didn't get talked about in Vancouver either, except in my, the only time I got the plenary floor to say that it hadn't been talked about, with the agreement of Philip Potter and Ted Scott, and that it ought to be talked about. One other thing did happen, though. And that was one of the dramatic convergences at Vancouver. And that is the growth of a non-pacifist nuclear peace movement that is just war pacifism, using the mainline assumption that war is sometimes justified, but not always, applying that to nuclear war, at least the potential for all-out nuclear war, and in the minds of many, even preparation for nuclear war. Everybody knows about the American Roman Catholic bishops, about the strong movement in continental Europe since 2 or 3 years ago, with much older input from the Dutch Reformed Church, so that there was strong pressure. It could hardly have been otherwise, but still it had to be looked through. And the Council did come up with a statement condemning nuclear war, condemning preparation for nuclear war, and waffling a little around the edges about deterrence, because there are hard edges and the difficult borderlines to be drawn when you're making that kind of statement. But there was a strong peace statement, if by peace we mean a moral judgment on the nuclear arms race. It was fed into not only by the general mood around the world, but by some specific agencies and events. Swedish bishop had convened all on his own a special consultation in order to try to contribute toward motion in that direction. A coalition of other Christian peace agencies got out a statement, and in fact circulated many copies of a newspaper format set of statements. There was a peace and justice coffee house on the edge of the campus, which had a strong program of marginal events, which once overlapped, in fact, with the interfaith dialogue, but also had surprisingly large crowds. So that there was strong pressure on the campus and in the assembly for a non-pacifist peace statement. And a non-pacifist peace statement came out. It was quite strong.
Thank you. It's your turn. I think maybe people need to know more about you as well. That's what we're doing.
Well, I'm a Brazilian. My church is called Evangelical Church of Lutheran Confession in Brazil. We are known as the of the Lutheran Confession. I'm a layman, a civil engineer, and a small Brazilian exporter. We have gone through, it's now 8 years, of a fight, of a struggle that was imposed upon us by a big transnational company named André of Lausanne, Switzerland. And these were very hard years, full of suffering. And during these years, my church supported me as a church can support a person in such a situation, morally, being on our side. And even in the newspaper of our church, we have, it's called Evangelical Newspaper, comes out twice a month. There were some articles about transnational, especially in our case. Well, the thing is that this fight made out of us Christians, if I could say that. So it deepened and strengthened our faith. I think that was the greatest surprise I ever had in my life was when I received a telephone call from the church in October 81 saying that I had been elected a delegate to the Vancouver Assembly. This was something I have had never even imagined that such could happen to me. Well, our church sent 4 delegates. Pastor Rita Panke, a woman pastor, to represent the 400 pastors of our church. Jeanette Bechtold, a female youth, to represent the young part of the church. Meine Piske to represent the board of the church. He's a vice president. He is a regional pastor, which is the same as a bishop. We don't use the title bishop in our church. And myself representing the lay people. So it was a very balanced team. And my work started in April 82 when we had, the Latin Americans had a first meeting in Mexico when we worked over a document. And in this document, to my surprise, I was one of the people who talked less about transnationals in Mexico. Although the only one personally affected by it, by a transnational, the feeling in Latin America is against transnationals is very strong. It is because we in Latin America, we have the bad aspects of the transnationals. That is because transnationals can be a wonderful sign of life. And they can be wonderful and very good, and they do a lot of good things. The trouble is that with us in Latin America, we see them only on the exploiting side. In Mexico, I was invited to go on the team visit to Cuba, which was very good. We had been, Ruth and I, in Cuba in 58, 3 months before the revolution of Castro came through. So it was a chance to see what happened. And also of the work done in Mexico, I was invited to be part of the team which visited the Nordic countries, specifically Denmark and Sweden. As a matter of fact, my part was more as a participant in the Third World Weeks of the Danish and of the Swedish churches. And I can tell you that I worked very hard since April last year on the theme, on all the books that the World Council sent me and so forth. And then we, Latin Americans, had another preliminary meeting in Panama in April this year. And so I came to Vancouver also with our church saying, whatever you people do, you know what you have to do, and that's it. And I told the president of my church that I would concentrate on transnationals. Justice, and this was issue 6, struggling for justice and human dignity. And in small groups, I saw the assembly working up. First, the small groups meeting that you came to know people and so forth. And what were the preoccupations of each of the participants in the small groups, 20 people, 20 to 25 persons of different denominations and different countries? We had in our group five Orthodox, meaning four bishops. And then we had people from Eastern Europe. We had one from Indonesia, one from Sudan, and myself, the only Latin American. The group spoke in German. And this came up through the clusters, which again were of 8 or 10 small groups together from the cluster. And the other week, then we had the small groups always going on. And then we had the issues being worked out. And, well, I'm very glad, and I said this on the floor of the assembly, I had the opportunity to speak 4 times. I don't know why, because in Latin American or in the layman, all this sums up. And I said on the floor that there were perhaps very few persons who enjoyed the assembly as much as I did. I like to meet people, and, well, I met a lot of people. And it was really nice to have persons of other denominations. Just open their hearts, you know. No trouble. It was as if, well, everyone very conscious and very identified with his own denomination, but at the same time, above this being a Christian. This is something that you feel there, that you are a Christian, first place, and second place, you are a Lutheran or a Methodist and so forth. And even the Orthodox, you sensed this, that they wanted to share, they wanted to be part of the family. I think the Orthodox, although they claim to have the longest tradition in church, and this it would be a dispute between them and the Roman Catholics, but you sense that they want to be part of the family, they want to share. They don't want to be looked as strange Orthodox people. And I think what we had to do from Brazil, we accomplished. The TNC, the continuation of the program on transnational companies, was one of the first guidelines, completely approved. And we Brazilians, who had been neglected by the nomination committee, they forgot that 85% of the membership of the churches in Latin America belonging to the World Council are Brazilians. And so for the 4 positions in the Central Committee, they put us only with 1. We have a right mathematically to 3, but Brazil never wants this. Brazil only wants 2 and leaves the 3rd position between the other brothers of smaller churches in Latin America. And so we had to fight it on the floor. Unfortunately, the good friendship of Latin Americans prevailed, and there was a friendship solution. And we got also a member of our church on the Central Committee. So it was a week, these were 3 weeks of hard work, of really hard work. I'm putting in this since April 81, I'm working on that. I could say that perhaps this year more than 50% of my time was taken by the World Council of Churches, because I also had, in Panama, I had taken upon me the responsibility to get the Latin American documents translated into the other official languages, even into Russian. It happened, I don't know, but in any case, we got it. And the Russians were very satisfied. They said it's the first time that somebody from the other part of the world translates something into Russian. Usually they have to translate in our languages. So, and I'm very gratified by this. I think that this time it was a very good investment. I'm very happy about it, and I'm very joyful. And I think the whole meeting in Vancouver, there were differences. For instance, I did not like, and I put it in my writing, written report to the World Council, that whenever a serious question arises, the Russian Orthodox still use the language of a certain menace. They say, we are arriving at a very delicate point of the whole ecumenical movement.
And this I don't like. I think that this must be sharing, and you must understand that sometimes you will lose. You will not be convinced, but you will lose. Then let's go ahead in the next 10 to 7 years into the next assembly to stress our points. And Latin Americans were all very good friends, and we made a good group, and we had very good understandings with our neighbors in front, the Australians, and in the back, the Canadians. We get very good relations. I think that's a very personal. This is not this is not a theological complicated thing. It's just a personal experience.
Oh, thank you. And finishing up right now, John DeGushi.
We South Africans were between the Polish and the Americans. with Togo and one or two other places. I guess there are a lot of things that each of us could and would like to talk about, such as the Baptism, Eucharist and Ministry document and a few other things. And I'd also like to stress the importance of the worship for me and for many others. But perhaps it would be most helpful if I reflected as a South African upon the assembly, because invariably that was the capacity in which a South African is at such an event, whether you like it or not. That's what you're there for, or at least that's who you are when you are there. And that can be quite an unnerving experience, especially if this is the first kind of thing you've been to that kind. It wasn't mine. I've been to several similar events over the past 20 years. But I know for South Africans, the one question that you often dread is when a person says to you, where do you come from? Because you know that that's going to lead to a discussion. That's going to make you late for either breakfast or bed, or just be downright unpleasant. So it's a problematic thing. I attended a Faith and Order conference in Leuven in Belgium in 1971, and for 3 days I felt as though I had some contagious disease. Nobody wanted to talk to a white South African. And of course, when you get back to South Africa, they feel that you've got a contagious disease also, because you've been with the World Council of Churches. The background to South African participation, I think, is important to understand the kind of dynamics of our involvement. South Africa has been on the agenda of the World Council at least since Evanston in 1954, when it was singled out as the example of racism, quite rightly so. And that was at a time when very few countries got onto the agenda, but South Africa was there. The Dutch Reformed Church, the White Dutch Reformed Church in South Africa, was a founding member in 1948, but by 1961 in New Delhi, it had withdrawn, which indicates that already 20 years ago, there was a growing opposition to the World Council amongst at least a very powerful section of the South African white community. This was became intensified when the program to combat racism was launched at the end of the 1960s, so much so that from around about 1974, no World Council of Churches staff person has been granted a visa to visit South Africa, although one or two have got in some other kind of way. But it would have been totally impossible, for example, for a team from the World Council to have visited South Africa in preparation for the Vancouver Assembly. I guess there weren't many countries in the world of which this was true. So the World Council gets a very high profile, but a very negative, an extremely negative profile in South Africa from the point of view of the powers that be, but also from other quarters as well. No funds, for example, can be sent from the South African member churches, of which there are, I think, 9 now, to the World Council of Churches. And there's continual pressure upon these churches in South Africa, which my own church is a member as well, continual pressure to withdraw from the World Council of Churches. And this has been going on now for 10 years. Sometimes we believe it's quite a miracle that we've not only managed to weather that storm, but be strengthened in the process. And some of us believe that the South African government is somehow involved in the funding of many anti-World Council of Churches organizations and publications in many different parts of the world. So that is a necessary background, at least some of it, to understand South African involvement. South African delegation at Vancouver was quite strong. There were about 60 South Africans there, which must be one of the larger, I think, national groupings. Not all of these were delegates representing their churches. I happened to be a delegate, and I think there were about 30 delegates, 29, 30 delegates from the member churches. Then there were delegates from the South African Council of Churches. There were a whole bunch of observers, people who had been given observer status. Interesting story about some observers. I remember in the early days of the meeting, of the assembly, a South African coming up to me and saying, had I detected the security police representatives from South Africa at the assembly? And I said, no. So he said, well, he had been encountered by these two young white Afrikaans South Africans with short back and side haircuts and dressed just like the security police would dress when they're not in uniform, which I seldom are. And he had met them as he was going into a Africa regional meeting. Well, I happened to meet these two men the next day and suddenly realized what had happened. They were two young Afrikaans theologians, theological students from Pretoria, who were beginning to break with their church on these kind of issues and had managed to raise the funds to get to Vancouver to come and experience this so that they could see things in a new way, and they were all excited, and they had in fact written to me in Princeton to say could they meet with me at Vancouver. They somehow knew that I was going to be there, and they had sent a letter to me through the internal mail system at Vancouver. And so when I sat down and I saw them, I said, you must be the security police. But that is paralleled by another interesting situation one evening when the South African delegation got together. And when South Africans got together, it didn't matter whether you were an official delegate or an observer or even from the press, although on certain occasions we asked the press whether they were sympathetic or not to leave. But in the South African contingent were quite a number of black exiles and some people involved in the liberation movements, the African National Congress. And at the first meeting, the atmosphere is fairly highly charged. Not because we didn't know each other. We have very, very many occasions to meet like that, black and white in South Africa, far more, I think, than black and white meeting in, let's say, North America. And so there's a great level of personal knowledge and trust, etc., etc. But there were some strange faces. And there was one face that didn't have a card on. And if you didn't have an identification card at the assembly, you just were a non-entity.
Wouldn't get in.
You couldn't do anything. But if you came into a South African meeting without a card, you were immediately suspect as representing some evil force. And the whole meeting of 60 of us were suddenly conscious. You don't represent the security police, do you? When you see somebody doing something strange, you jump to their conclusion. All of us were suddenly aware that there was this person there without a label. And the conversation was stifled. We couldn't get going. We all knew why we couldn't get going. We all knew it. And eventually it got to the point where somebody nudged me and said, wouldn't you go and find out who that person is? And so I moved around quite as I could and asked various people, who's that woman over there? And finally, I as nobody knew, I got up behind her and I said, who are you?
That loud?
Yeah, almost. And she told me who she was, and once we cleared that up, it was okay, and we could continue. But we met as South Africans on many occasions and worked through the issues. And it was like replaying many a discussion and debate which we have in South Africa itself. Well, South Africa wasn't as highly on the agenda of the Vancouver Assembly as it sometimes is, although a major document was prepared on Southern Africa, which South Africans were very much involved in preparing. And South Africa surfaced at a number of other points as an illustration of racism and in other ways. in the whole discussion on what is called status confessionis and heresy today and confessing church and so forth. It is, I think, interesting that two of the people who had the highest profile at Vancouver were South African church leaders, Alan Busack, the black Dutch Reformed leader, a young theologian of 37, 38, who certainly, I think, has a tremendous contribution to make and is making at this time, and Desmond Tutu, the black Anglican bishop. And I think that the South African input by these two men was very, very significant for the Assembly. I speak as a biased person, of course, in that regard. And there was a sense in which, for the South African delegation, this Assembly was a relief insofar as we realized that many other situations in the world have similar problems to the ones that we're struggling with, but also a sense of strengthening and solidarity because of the awareness of Christians all over the world supporting us in their prayers as we seek to support them in prayers and in other ways. And I leave you with one comment of Desmond Tutu, which he shared with me towards the end of the Assembly. He said, "Isn't it a miracle that there is such a thing as the World Christian Community, and to sense the solidarity that we experience on occasions like this?" And I think that's right.
You know, Gene is sitting here, and I would like to have you participate. It may cut down our discussion time a little bit, but I think you'd like to hear some of Gene Martinson's impressions. Can you come up?
Sure, I can sit right here too.
Patty, you want to wear whatever you want. You might be heard better with the microphone. Okay.
I went to the Assembly in the capacity of an accredited visitor. This is one of those categories where you wear one of the cards and you follow the Assembly from beginning to end. And you participate, I think, in every way that the delegates do, only more so, because the public program this year had a whole series of ecumenical programs, such as the coffee house that was mentioned, and the well, which was organized by Lemon, and was offered at the Lutheran Center, right adjacent to the main building where the Assembly had its big plenary gatherings. The credited visitors were about 600 people that were there from beginning to end, and then we had several thousand visitors that came, as many as many of the people here in Holden indicated they had come that way. This was an extreme privilege for those of us from North America. The Canadians and the North Americans felt that they were grateful that at this point in their own religious life, this assembly was held and they could be a part of it, because it's something not very many of us will be able to do again unless we're elected by our churches to go to a national assembly, I mean a world assembly. There were 8 LCA people and about the same from the ALC, so you have some idea of how limited the spaces are among the delegates. I think that I had, speaking out of my own background as a lay person and as a person who taught literature at one point in her life and worked with migrant workers in California, which was the beginning of a whole new direction in my own life, brought me into civil rights work for city government and into the use of Paulo Freire's methods in Geneva, a Brazilian educator who has had a phenomenal impact worldwide. His book, The Pedagogy of the Oppressed, was the first one that made such an impact. I think that the three things that I reacted to personally at the Assembly was after we had shared all these stories for 2 weeks and took part in this rich liturgy, we experienced the Eucharist in a profoundly new fashion. From the time we've been very small, we've been told that each of us is made in the image of God. It's almost a cliche to hear it. But after you've heard these stories, and there were stories of suffering and empowerment and struggle, there was the divisiveness on the plenary floor, but you came to that Eucharist, and two people who stood before you offered you the elements, and you knew by their faces and the color of their skin and the clothing that they wore that they came from very different parts of the world than yourself. And this was multiplied by two, by two, by two, all over this surface underneath this big yellow and white tent. And so that really what some people have already alluded to today and what Dan said in his sermon last night about having as close a glimpse to the kingdom, I think, that he probably would ever have. We have a sense of that, that this Christian, universal Christian witness is real. And I mean, for me, that was one of the high points, looking in the eyes of these two people that shared the sacraments and then going through this whole liturgy. And I think the fact that it came when it did, when you'd heard all these stories. It's very hard for me to talk because this afternoon we talked about suffering. And here at Holden, and we got into analysis of how individual our suffering is in North America. And the kinds of words we use to describe suffering were brokenness, loneliness, a whole string of very good words to describe suffering. But it wasn't until later that we recognized that the corporate dimension of suffering, when the whole church suffers together, was something we rarely do in this country. And so the Eucharist brought all that suffering and all that joy together. So that was one thing for me. Then the second thing, I think because of my work in civil rights earlier, when we met as a U.S. delegation, and there were about 300 of us in the room, we made up a statement on Central America. And we told our government that we really didn't approve of the policies in Central America. And we signed this paper together with Central Americans in the field after we had agreed, you know, we worked out, small committees had worked it out. And this was an important act of solidarity between Central American peoples and ourselves. And we also did this on South Africa, a statement to our government. But then the second time when we met, as a U.S. delegation, several hundred people, all the different confessions in the room, the Black Caucus had met in the interim. And they reminded us that if we were going to talk about solidarity with Central America and solidarity with those who suffer in South Africa and how much we disapproved of our government's policies, then we better pay attention to what's happening in the United States. And they ran off a whole litany of racist, yeah, kinds of activities that as whites today, I think we close our eyes to. They talked about police beatings, the numbers of young people on drugs, the unemployment. I mean, these are newspaper, but you know, newspaper items, we know this intellectually, we're illiterate people, but we didn't hear it in precisely the same way as these black brothers and sisters were telling us. And they almost accused us. They said, you know, you want us to be part of this ecumenical worldwide Christian family. You got these independent black churches here. Now that we're here, you're going to take our problems as well as the people. Because, you know, we carry our problems with us. And if we're going to do this ecumenical witnessing, in a sense, we're going to do it together. So they reminded us of the Ku Klux Klan, and they named numbers of paramilitary training operations in Southwest California or southern parts of the United States, and all the things that our churches, I think, are trying to warn us about, because stuff does come out from boards of social ministry on it. But when I mentioned this earlier to John, just about Oregon and Isabel, about how many times blacks and whites are working together in South Africa, coalitions that are forming that are dealing with this. You want to say what you said about your response?
Well, I think in South Africa, blacks and whites come together much more to work at the issues than I think happens in North America. Is that what I said?
Yeah. And that we are really, even though we have our integrated advertising and our signs of accomplishments, in many ways, a very separate, you know, twin societies running parallel. And the media can trick us into thinking we've accomplished more than we have. And working in civil rights to see the erosion of everything that was painfully fought for, just like somebody has a piece of yarn, and it just, you know, it's just unraveling it just like that. And a lot more is going on at the federal level than most people ever care to find out. So that's that. And the third thing for me was the renewal aspect. The well was really the well.
It was wonderful.
It was wonderful. Because the well is a universal symbol. It's really, you know, so many women of the world walk to the well to get water, and water is life. And they walk back, but while they're there, that's where they visit. And our laundromats aren't quite the same. There is a lot of visiting of people that go there every week at the same time and get to know each other. But the well, in terms of imagery, the well was back to human scale. These massive, you know, the massive plenary gathering. You saw slides that some of you did when John showed this morning. It was mammoth, the whole, that many thousands of people. And the tent had its own environment, yellow and white, and the whole spirit of anticipation, the smell of the grass. And at night, when it was all luminous, it was really an image that will carry with us a long time. The fact of, if you stayed the day after it disappeared, which we agreed was a very apt symbol for a pilgrim people. But the well, being adjacent to all that was happening, was a place where women came in a low, a one-story building, white, dark brown timbers, a little courtyard with grass and stones, and we sat there with our brown bags because it was almost always overflowing. They didn't anticipate the interest. They had planned, I don't know how many people for the night call to come, and Dorothy Sola spoke, and it was 500, and they had to do videotapes and everything else. It was just far more interest than anybody had imagined. So every day they would plan a lunch or an afternoon session. It was very simple and almost, you'd say, understated, but very eloquently women told their story. Some of it was analytical, some of it was personal, some of it was very different from anything you've ever heard, and a lot was very, very similar. And you felt that, you know, this worldwide sisterhood was coming into being, and that there was already an influence on the assembly. And when I was over in Geneva, I'm talking way beyond 5 minutes.
Very
nice.
You're
not
25.
Well, just one more image. The image over in the Ecumenical Center, we have all the founding fathers of the churches. And with all due respect to all these creative geniuses that brought this ecumenical movement into being, I missed images of women in these photographs. The first, you know, the first picture following the war, of course, was a very dreary time, and the whole photograph in black and white, 7% women, dark-suited peoples, you know, 93% men standing there in very somber tones, and very almost somber faces, because they had come out of the Second World War. And now you see today, I mean, if you could, the every color, batiks and saris and all this marvelous
African women dresses.
Well, everywhere, Indonesian, Indian, Pakistan. I mean, it was this marvelous array inside the tent every morning. I mean, that the color and the texture and the way of being together. I think that women, you know, they were nourished at the well, and it's beginning to make an impact on the assembly life. The women came 1 week early to form a community together to practice speaking before the microphones so they wouldn't be intimidated by 1,000 people. And, you know, that was an important solidarity building. And the youth also, they had their sessions. In fact, if any group got itself to organize quickly, it was the young people who objected strongly to the fact that they were losing seats that they had felt had been promised to them. And they spoke up from the floor. They said you have to be a bishop in order to speak. They noted who had spoken the first day, and they organized immediately to try and convince the assembly that the future of the church included youth, and that they wanted their seats.
So
they were able to get some of them too.
Could I comment just 2 minutes? Two things that for us Latin Americans were, well, some of us got tears in the eyes. We had a Latin American meeting quite, on the first Monday. And then already there was the air that the Nicaraguans and the Americans would meet. And they met, this was before the document came out, and then the covenant between the churches of the United States and Central America. This was really something that touched us all very much. And then there was a meeting between the Argentinians and the British, shepherded by Brazilians and others, Latin Americans. But this also was a very interesting meeting, that they are trying through the churches to come together. This was also a very highly emotional meeting, and it meant very much for all the people involved. Then there was, as always, we third world people, we claim things. It is established, John told it, that you have to have so many percentage of women, so many percentage of youth. Now you look at the North Atlantic representations, and then there are only male and bishops. So that really the youth and the women come from the third world countries in a larger percentage from our countries than, so to make up the 20% in the third, 20%, yes. And also it was true that in the beginning, only the bishops got the word. And when people claimed that this was not right, then the others began. And there was a youth, he said, I'm very happy, Mr. Moderator, because I'm the first young person to talk. This really.
Oh, wow. Thank you, all of you. I think you have a sense of what kind of a gift we have in the village this week. For these 10 days to have these fine and inspirational people among us,
to sit down and have a meal with them, to come to their various sessions, all of which are taped, to get a glimpse not only of this assembly, but of what it represents in living human beings, how they carry back to us the spirit that was present there. How much more we are again united with the whole church, Christ's church in his large and small world that we live in. I would like to close with prayer. Lord, we are at once inspired and challenged. We are small as we picture this large and diverse world. Yet we have some power of the Spirit among us here in this community because you have given to us people who can tell us about this experience and share with us that fellowship that we read about at the beginning, who bring to us that word manifest in our lives and the possibility and the hope that it offers to all of us. Let us sit under the great tent of these mountains and share in worship and communion and love and respect, and help us, Lord, to understand better what it is you would have this world of yours be. We are most grateful, Lord, for our lives and for this possibility of sharing the feast of life together. Amen.